On this week's 51%, reversing the roles in one of Shakespeare's tragedies.
Stories about women and girls are just as rich and interesting and complex as stories about boys and men, that it's not just about girls in relationship to boys.
We hear from a transgender service member on balancing identity and serving the country, plus a woman creates the tiniest museum in her city. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
If she fights when her clothes you are mussing, what are clothes much ado about nothing? Brush up your Shakespeare, and they'll all kowtow.
With the wife of the British ambassador, try a crack out of Troilus and Cressida.
If she says she won't buy it or like it, make her take it, what's more, as you like it. If she says your behavior is heinous.
In this case, brushing up on your Shakespeare includes reversing genders in the roles. This production of William Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Julius Caesar is being staged at the State University of New York at New Paltz. It was director Lauren Bone Noble's idea.
And Allison, when I first thought of it, I thought the gender would play more a part of the story. But what it really is the youth. It's the age of the characters. I think when I watched that assassination scene, it's watching these young people play out this violence that is, I think, more jarring than seeing middle-aged guys do it in togas. Like, the distance of history and age is what ended up making it more urgent, I think, and provocative, having young people
more urgent
do
than
it.
The gender?
Maybe the gender plays a part, too. I mean, I have to admit that the fact that they're young women is also very provocative, but something about the youth, if they were middle-aged women, I think it would not be as distressing as young women, you know? So yes, maybe it's the combination of the age and the gender. But the age, I think, makes the bigger difference in some ways.
So when you initially thought, okay, I want to gender reverse this play,
mm-hmm.
The Tragedy of Julius Caesar,
yes.
And you probably had a different vision because, as you just said, what you're seeing play out is more the youth that's mm-hmm. impacting the roles and the message and everything and the violence. Then, so is it turning out differently than you had envisioned?
In some ways, yes. I hadn't envisioned that it would be this sort of dark fairy tale, but that is what has emerged as we've worked on it. The thing that interests me most about the idea of a dark fairy tale is we tend to soften childhood or adolescence and our memory of it as if it wasn't complicated or we didn't have dark feelings or sensual feelings or vengeful feelings, but we did. You know, if you really think back to childhood and certainly adolescence, and the complexity of the life of young people, I think, is one of the things that I've been interested in exploring and acknowledging, that we're not just light and we're not just dark, but we're kind of a mix of those things, and they are natural. It's natural to have dark feelings. Certainly, we don't all want to run around stabbing people, but the part that I think the environment that allows something like this to happen is maybe one where darkness is repressed and not acknowledged until it bursts out in this horrible way.
SUNY New Paltz senior Aisha Selig, who plays Brutus, recalls her reaction when she heard the play would put women in the men's roles.
Oh, I was so excited because so much of theater is very male-driven, and I'm also a person of color and I'm a woman, so there are very few and far roles presented for me. So when I found out that we were having and this is a very large cast, having this immense cast of women be here, and I knew that I had a greater chance of being in it, which, you know, luckily for me I am. And I think it's incredible.
Sophomore Emily DeMayo plays Casca.
Playing this role as a female has been an eye-opening experience because you always see it played by middle-aged old men, and to bring it to a context in which we're living in today is just mind-boggling to me. It's so much fun.
The play is true to the text, save for changed pronouns and a few phrases like queenly crowned instead of kingly crowned. Lauren Bone Noble, who in addition to directing the play, is a faculty member in the Theater Arts Department of SUNY New Paltz's School of Fine and Performing Arts. and she talks about her gender message.
It's not the show, but the casting. And what I want to say is stories about women and girls are just as rich and interesting and complex as stories about boys and men, that it's not just about girls in relationship to boys, but girls in relationship to each other and friendship and loyalty and revenge and ambition. And it has nothing to do with, oh, I like him, she likes him, let's fight about him. It doesn't really have anything to do with the boyfriends. It has to do with their relationships with each other. And that's, if I'm saying anything about gender, that's what I'm saying. And also to anybody in the audience, that these words are for you. They're not just for guys or English guys in their middle age. It's for all people to speak these words. If you can think of a concept to lay in, do it. Try it. That's what I want to say with that, I think.
And what do you want an audience member to leave after seeing this production to think? I mean, we all are going to interpret it our own ways, clearly, just with any work of art, but...
I want us to consider our complicity in violence, because I think we have a tendency to look at violent behavior and say, oh, that's so terrible, it's over there. You know, when the shootings happened in Oregon, it's so far away, it's that town over there, and anytime it happens, people say, I can't believe it happened here. But I'm no different than a woman living in Syria. I'm no different than a woman living in Oregon. We're all just humans, and the violence is, and it's not separate from us. So I would like people to feel like, what's my part in the violent world in which I live, and how can I change it? Am I being silent? Am I playing into fear somehow? Am I not hearing when people are talking to me about being violent? I don't know, but it's something about that, I think, Allison, about what part do we all play in a violent world?
Aisha Sullig, the young woman playing Brutus, points out something else about the production.
We have a trans actor in the play here who is currently being murdered. But I think it's very important to have this actor be here because it shows the terrible things that are going on to people who we don't even acknowledge in society today, and the trans community is constantly yelling out and saying protect us, and I think having this person in the play have violence against him, it's going to make people a little bit more aware of the fact that this is reality. Like, what I enjoy about this play so much is that this is real. Because in the beginning of the process, we were all like, oh my God, why would these girls do this? Turn on the news. It's everywhere.
That transgender actor to whom she refers is Rain Grayson.
So I love that it's just like, it's just there. It's not really a big thing. You know, it's not like I'm this huge character in the show. It's just I'm there. And I love that it's just, I think it's just a cherry on top of the realism of the whole thing.
I dreamt last night that I did feast with Caesar. And things unluckily charge my fantasy.
Lauren, I wanted to ask you about the transgender role and how you had first envisioned it and how it might have changed.
Okay, well, I'd originally envisioned the role of Cinna the Poet as a transgender girl, so someone who was born a boy but felt themselves to be a girl and that was living fully as a girl, and I'd intended to cast that part as a male actor and then have them dress as a girl. I was concerned all along, though, I didn't want it to look like drag, because that's something very different, right, than being transgender. And then the actor who was playing the part came along to auditions, who I did not know, a new student here, and he is transgendered, and he gave this remarkable audition, and I called him back, and it was beautiful, and I felt like it was a gift to me, and so I changed the part to a transgender boy, so someone who has arrived on campus of our imaginary Rome Preparatory Academy as a girl, but feeling themselves to be a boy, and is just starting to transition and express their gender identity. It's a careful line to straddle because it's not in the text. So we have to be careful and show it so the audience isn't confused, what's this boy doing here? So costume, we have to imply what we're doing. I don't know if it'll be confusing. I hope it isn't. Hopefully people are now used to transgender people in their lives so that it won't be as confusing, especially here on the campus at SUNY New Paltz. I hope it's an environment in which transgender students feel safe and welcome to express themselves. It's certainly been, as a faculty member, we've been encouraged to be rigorous in our fair treatment and making sure we ask, what do you want to be called? What pronoun do you like? It's a whole new world, Allison. It's changing.
I attended rehearsal one of the days fight choreographer John Patrick Hayden was on hand. He notes a difference working with female fight scenes.
From a completely stage combat point of view and a violence point of view, it's actually a lot easier to get to the work, because with males, there's a lot of posturing, And so when you actually do violent scenes, it usually takes a while to get them to actually get in there and get in touch. Whereas you normally find that when a female fights, they, you know, when actually it's time to fight, and that's it, they'll argue that it's time to fight, it's hair, eyes, and genitals. That's it. Hairs, eyes, and genitals. When men fight, it's 30 minutes of shoulder to shoulder, you know, dancing around the room. I'm going to do this. Well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, well, you can kind of see it, right? And all their friends get around, and then they kind of, it's all this like peacocky, chest puffy kind of gorilla chest pumping kind of stuff with usually like one punch, you know?
The play's depiction of violence is a reminder of daily headlines. Campus shootings, for example, of which there have been more than 20 in 2015, including at a community college in Oregon. Rain Grayson says casting women in the male roles brings more attention to violence.
For me, personally, if I was watching Julius Caesar and I watched a whole bunch of dudes in togas go at it, I wouldn't care, because you're desensitized to it. You already see that in the history books. You read book upon book upon book about, oh yeah, like, these historical men will kill each other, and we are attuned to that. Nobody thinks about women killing each other, or women being violent and murderous and awful, and where that falls and everything. And I think it needs to be said.
Selig also places importance on the play's violence.
The gender of the character really doesn't matter. I think it's more the modernizing of how violence is still apparent in this society. Because I think a lot of the time when we think of heavy violence, we think of like gladiators and all of the, you know, great like Greek wars, the Trojan War, and all of those things. So having this play be placed here in this time, I think, is really important, because there has been so much murder happening in the news as of late, and I don't think a lot of people are really taking it seriously.
Senior Iris Fine plays Julius Caesar.
You know, like, it just says that these girls are, I mean, they could do as much damage as men can do. They can, they could tear people to shreds, and that's basically what comes to mind with me. Like, just the fact that you could be so brutal, it doesn't matter, like, you're just being a person who's brutal and intense and will fight and will gather a crowd together and band together and follow each other and kill somebody.
Bone Noble speaks to why she chose to have the play set at a girls' boarding school.
Well, because a boarding school allows us to remove the characters from control of their parents. So if I'm a young person, I'm going home every night having dinner with my parents, and they're, you know, grilling me about what I did all day and who I'm hanging out with and what's going on. Something like this might not be as likely to happen. It's sort of the conceit of Harry Potter, right? That at boarding school, they're allowed to get into all kinds of trouble, that if they were at home and they went home at night, it wouldn't happen. So it allows us to see them separated from the adult world. And it also kind of highlights that bubble of youth in which we look to our peers for answers and guidance in a way that when we're children, little children, we go directly to our parents. But teenagers have a tendency to seek the counsel of their peers, right, instead of adults.
Did you get the idea from Harry Potter?
No, I think the idea came from an article I had read when I was in college a Rolling Stone article about a young girl, a teenage girl who had killed, stabbed to death a friend of hers who was more popular, who was treating her badly. I'd actually written a paper about it in college because it resonated with me so much, this whole friction around social maneuvering in high school and how hurtful people can be to each other in that environment and how stuck you can feel. I'm the nerd, I'm the geek, I'm the popular one, I'm the homecoming queen, I'm the jock. And you can't get out of it until you leave high school. And I think that's when the seed was kind of planted many, many years ago. I didn't realize it until maybe halfway through rehearsal that that's where it grew out of.
Lauren Bone Noble is directing Julius Caesar at SUNY New Paltz. Performances run through November 22nd. 4 years after the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Department of Defense is preparing to lift the ban on transgender service in the military. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter has formed a working group to study just how to do that. As the Pentagon considers the change, transgender service members have to walk a fine line between regulations and their identity. Patricia Murphy reports.
The Peace household in Spanaway, Washington can be a very busy place.
Hey, are y'all gonna be nice?
Captain Jennifer Peace and her wife Debbie have been married for 11 years. They have three kids, cats, and two dogs.
You can say hi, but you're not gonna jump.
Peace is an intelligence officer at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. She deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan as a man. And though her evaluations were good, she struggled with the way her body looked, with depression. So nearly 2 years ago, with her wife's support, Peace started medically transitioning from male to female. It was a decision that had potentially devastating consequences for her career.
I was scared the entire time. Me and Debbie had so many conversations about what are we going to do if I do get kicked out? You know, I've got three kids and a mortgage just like everyone else. And this is what I know is the Army. What do I do if it's gone tomorrow?
The Army didn't discharge Peace. She's still an intelligence officer. And the Pentagon is now moving toward allowing transgender people to serve openly. Under an order from Secretary Carter, involuntary discharges for transgender service members must now be reviewed by a senior Pentagon official. It's part of Carter's efforts to make the military more diverse.
Because we need to be a meritocracy. We have to focus relentlessly on our mission, which means the thing that matters most about a person is what they can contribute to national defense.
But until the Defense Department crafts formal policies about transgender service members, Peace is in a complicated and sometimes frustrating position. She's been ordered to get her haircut shorter, like a man's. Even though she has legally changed her name, Peace's soldiers are under orders to address her as Sir. And when they didn't do it, everyone was reprimanded.
My soldiers were called in and they said, "What are you calling Captain Peace? What were you told to call Captain Peace?" And there was finally a thing where I was called in and my direct supervisor said, "Hey, Captain Peace, I need you to start correcting people's pronouns."
Haircuts and pronouns will likely be addressed by Secretary Carter's working group, as will some potentially bigger issues, like whether transgender troops will be excluded from any military jobs. Aaron Belkin is the director of the Palm Center, an independent research institute that focuses on gender, sexuality, and the military. He says the Pentagon faces a lot of policy decisions in the coming months, but he says British, Australian, and Canadian forces already have inclusive policies for transgender personnel.
In all of those experiences, sure, culture changes a bit because the troops aren't used to serving in general with openly transgender personnel. But the implementation issues are not difficult to solve.
The frustration for transgender troops now is the time it's taking to solve those issues. Sue Fulton, a former Army captain, is president of SPARTA, a not-for-profit that supports LGBT military veterans and their families.
We're in a situation where there's a widespread recognition that the old policies don't work and a strong intent to set the right policies, to do the right thing, to make sure they're doing the right thing is going to take time.
And Fulton knows she was in the first class of women to graduate from West Point. And while Jennifer Peace admits she's impatient, she's also hopeful.
I think by this time next year, we'll be talking about how well the implementation has gone.
She hopes by then the focus will be on her job performance and not her gender. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
And her report is from American Homefront Project, and you can find them online at AmericanHomefrontProject.org. The smallest museum in St. Paul, Minnesota, is a vintage fire hose cabinet just outside the door of the Workhorse Coffee Bar. It's the brainchild of Shannon Forney, and it displays exhibits of miniature art and artifacts with different curators each month. KFAI's Dixie Treichel reports.
It's got this kind of old lock.
How many ways could you be creative with a vintage fire hose cabinet? Shannon Forney and Ty Barnett, owners of the Workhorse Coffee Bar, have transformed the one outside their front door into the smallest museum in St. Paul. It displays curated exhibits of miniature art and artifacts, led by museum founder Shannon Forney.
So when we put out the call for proposals, it was not just a call to artists. It was to artists, makers, historians, creators of all types. You don't have to be in the coffee shop to see it. You can be on the sidewalk and see it. And it's got a glass front and the little hinged door, and there's a little keyhole. And so there's something kind of Alice in Wonderland, like magical curio cabinet, secretly kind of hidden in the wall.
It measures 32 inches wide by 28 inches high and 11 inches deep. A magnifying glass hangs on the bottom of the cabinet.
The door swings all the way open.
My name is Ruth Ann Gadali. I teach printmaking at McAllister College. I'm the curator for Read the Fine Print, a show of virtuoso tiny printmaking. The smallest print is about the size of half of a postage stamp, and it's multiple line poem plus an illustration set in just over 1 point type. So if you think you type right like on 12 point, imagine 1 point. It's a feat of tiny printmaking.
Now it is a little tight there.
My name is Jill Waterhouse. My piece, The Cabinet of Wonder, came out of a historical perspective on the natural world. There was a period of time where they created these things called cabinets of curiosity and wonder. And this was, I think, back in the 18 and early 1900s. So the main cabinet is actually a printer's drawer. Those printer drawers have little compartments that are all different sizes. So mine range from a little over 1 inch by 1 inch up to 7 inches high by 3 inches wide. Just some of the things that are in there, I have fish bones, petrified wood, a lot of handmade objects, the tiniest Tabasco sauce bottle I've ever seen, the tiniest pot holder. Then I have a lot of my own personal objects in there as well. In this piece, there are hundreds of little pieces, probably 200, 300, 400 by the time I'm done.
Tiny little vignettes.
And there's something about things that are really tiny. As a kid, I loved Barbie dolls, not for the Barbie dolls, but for the stuff, because everything was so small. You know, the shoes were tiny, the clothes were tiny. There was just something so wonderful about this world of teeny tiny things.
Founder Shannon Forney created the smallest museum in St. Paul to be an activity as well as a showcase, bringing the world of the tiny out of the rabbit hole and into the community.
We want people to be engaged, contributing to the art that's happening in there. But sometimes it might be signing a guest book or picking up the magnifying glass to really look at what's in the cabinet more closely. It's really about, does it draw you in? Does it make you curious?
This is Dixie Treichel for KFAI. 10,000 Fresh Voices on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1372.